Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to introduce my guest co-host today, Dr. Bhavani Murthy. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Murthy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
You know, it's really great to have you here today, and it's great that we've got some really interesting research that matters. And we'll also be talking with Dr. John Mandrola, who's a cardiologist, but also a columnist, otherwise known as Dr. John M. And we're going to be talking about some thoughts, important thoughts he has about screening for medical disease. I'm really looking forward to that conversation.
Me too.
But first, we've got some interesting research that matters about indoor tanning and melanoma. And
so a study came out in JAMA Dermatology, which found that women who had tanned indoors were more likely than those who did not to have cancer before they're 30.
Yeah, you know, the whole issue of indoor tanning and melanoma, it's one we've, Christy and I actually had talked about on the show in the past, and I'm sure a number of listeners are aware of. But this kind of research brings it home, and it's research that's in the United States and looking at particularly women under the age of 50 who did not have cancer diagnosed, who developed these melanomas, 680 adult patients. And the great majority of these women who developed cancer at an early age, this melanoma, the relationship to their tanning, what did they see?
So they found that for all the women that were in the study, the more number of tanning sessions that they had in the past, the more likely they were to get the diagnosis of melanoma.
Yeah, I found this remarkable that the women under age 40 who started tanning at age 16 on average compared to age 25, that those women reported an average of 100 tanning sessions. Whoa, I mean, this isn't like a small-time sort of thing. I don't know if I've never gone to a tanning.
I haven't either.
So maybe we don't quite get it fully, yeah. But maybe also we understand that these women had a several-fold increase of melanoma. This you know, which is, it shouldn't be happening at the rates that we are at the high rates in these particular women.
And more likely, they were also likely to have melanomas on the trunk, which, again, is more because of the exposure to the radiation during a tanning bed session.
So I know that there are laws that are coming up around the country. There are researchers. The real message for young women and men are really that tanning is not a safe way of proceeding. Indoor tanning, outdoor tanning, you can actually get artificial tans, which are safe ways of the color if you need that. But this is not good.
And for those who already have had tanning, it's important that they monitor for any skin changes so that they can catch something sooner, as early as possible. But if you are tanning, it's time to stop tanning indoors now.
Great message, Bhavani. Our next research that matters is about research that was in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, and it was about infectious diseases among patients who go to the emergency room. We think about the emergency room a lot of times for accidents and people who cut themselves or sprain bones or people who have chest pain. But this really is focusing in on something that's really treatable.
And it says that 13.5% of the emergency room visits among older people was because of infectious diseases, much more than heart attacks and heart failure combined.
Yeah, pneumonia, lower respiratory tract infections like pneumonia account for 25% of all ER visits for infectious diseases. And pneumonia alone counts for 17.5% of emergency room visits. And we actually have vaccinations that might reduce these types of infections. We have influenza vaccination, which we hope everyone has gotten. If they haven't, please do. There are pneumococcal vaccinations for large numbers of the population that may be at risk for these things.
And they actually said that that is exactly what we need to do. More than 40% of older adults do not get their pneumococcal vaccine, and about a third do not get the influenza vaccine. So here is a problem we are seeing where we can do something about.
Yeah, no controversy here. Please talk with your doctor. There is a new pneumococcal vaccination. we call it the pneumococcal 23 and a pneumococcal 13. That's an easy way, a 13 and a 23. Talk to your doctor if you had one, whether you should be having the second one to give you added protection. Let's talk about our next Bhavani, Research That Matters. It's really about several common conditions in the relationship between them: depression, stroke, and heart disease.
So this new study found that older adults who have serious depression symptoms tend to be more likely at risk for getting a stroke or heart disease. Now, keep in mind, this is just an association.
And this was research that was published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, and it was over 7,000 older adults from three large French cities between 1999 and 2001. And they were doing interviews when the study began and checked these large number of older adults at 2 years, 4 years, and 7 years after their initial interview to see how many of them had depressive symptoms and how many of these same people had depression each time, and then how many of them actually developed these problems with strokes or heart attacks.
And over 10 years of the study, they found that the more likely on more occasions that these older adults had depressive symptoms, the more likely their chance. So one thing we can say is if you seem to feel like you have a depression, then it's good to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I think this is a question. Maybe we need to change our risk factors for heart disease and strokes and depression. And boy, would that make a difference in people's lives. And we talk about screening for depression. That may be, and we're increasingly doing that. Maybe that's a screening test that's easy to do. There's not a whole lot of side effects from doing that. And it may save someone's life.
That's true.
Talking about lives and last research that matters about donating blood. What's this about?
So with the recent Zika virus outbreak that is going on, the American Association of Blood Banks have said that donors who have been to these countries when returning should wait 28 days before donating blood.
So this would be people who've gone clearly down to Brazil, Caribbean countries,
Central America, South America. Those are the areas that are currently actively transmitting Zika virus.
You know, I went to give blood 2 years ago, and I wasn't thinking too much about it. I said, have you traveled out of the United States in the last month? And I said, well, yeah, I was down in Haiti doing some volunteer work. And they said, oh, can't donate blood. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some common sense to protect people because we don't really know to what extent fully people could be infected and people are trying to get pregnant. I think this is a common sense thing. It also suggests for those of us who haven't traveled to these countries, maybe we need to step it up and get more blood.
And of course, this is very much precautionary, but it's very important to keep our blood banks safe.
I couldn't agree with you more. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. John Mandrola, Dr. John M., about screening for medical disease. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bhavani Murthy. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bhavani Murthy. Today on Conversations, Bhavani, we're talking with Dr. John Mandrola, electrophysiologist and columnist for TheHeart.org and Medscape. And we're talking about certainly his work that he does in electrophysiology and want to understand atrial fibrillation, but we're really talking about some of his thoughts and views and columns about screening for medical disease. Welcome, Dr. Mandrola.
Thank you.
You know, just for our listeners, we always like to know about the person behind whatever it is they're talking about. How did you get interested in medicine? And then how did you get interested in your field? And then what caused you to think about outside your field?
Sure. So I got interested in medicine, and I thank my guidance counselor for that because he told me that I wasn't smart enough to be a doctor. And that challenged me. And then when I went to college, I worked hard and studied science. And then I was actually going to be a graduate student and decided to go to medical school kind of as a backup. And then when I went to medical school, I fell in love with medicine and especially cardiology. When I trained in the 80s and 90s, cardiology was in its heyday. So I guess my mentors is what drove me into cardiology. And at that time, electrophysiology, my field was just beginning to be an interventional field where we could do things to fix things. And so it was an exciting time, and that's why I picked the field.
You know, I wonder if your advisor was the same one that I had in medical school or in college, because he said, I can probably get you into dentistry, but I don't think you're going to get into medical school. And I was like, but I don't want to be a dentist. I want to be a doctor. So when they called me years later to give to them, I said, you know what? I'm going to give to the school that took me into medical school, not that particular university, which will go nameless. I'm not going to mention Tufts University on the air. You know, tell us a little bit about your chosen profession, cardiology and electrophysiology. What are you interested in? And this is what you probably spend most of your time doing.
Yeah. I'm an electrophysiologist, and I work in Louisville, Kentucky, and it's private practice. And I work in a cardiology group, so I'm referred patients with heart rhythm disorders. So 95% of my practice is heart rhythm disorders, and a good chunk of that is atrial fibrillation. So it's a very specialized field. But interestingly, electrophysiology, although it's specialized, often goes back to the common denominator, which is basic, you know, health measures. And so that's kind of driven my interest in primary care and basic health.
And you are an expert in atrial fibrillation. Could you just tell us a little bit about what is atrial fibrillation? How is it treated? What are the symptoms?
Sure. You know, atrial fibrillation seen on an EKG, like a rhythm strip, is a chaotic rapid rhythm in the top chambers of the heart, which often leads to an irregular rhythm in the bottom chamber of the heart and an irregular pulse. And, you know, these electrical issues, the chaos in the top and bottom chamber, cause a lowering of the heart output, and often people feel symptoms from this. But you know, atrial fibrillation is more complicated than what it is electrically. And, you know, we used to think of AFib as its own disease. You know, you put it in a silo, you treat AFib, but now we know, or we're beginning to understand, that AFib is actually a manifestation of other things that affect the heart. You know, things like high blood pressure and sleep apnea that cause stress on the heart, obesity and body fat gets into the atrium itself and affects the electrical system. And so even patients with atrial fib that we didn't think had other diseases, actually, when we look closely, their atrium is showing signs of structural abnormalities. And so that's AFib, what it is, and it's tricky.
And on your blog, you have 13 things to know about atrial fibrillation, and one of your 13 things is that the treatment for atrial fibrillation can be worse than the actual condition. What did you mean by that?
Well, so that's the big thing with atrial fibrillation, and that's what makes it so tricky, is that my job as an AFib doctor is sort of to figure out atrial fibrillation in that person. AFib has to be individualized because it affects people so differently. A 75-year-old with rapid atrial fibrillation is really in a different situation than a 35-year-old with AFib that he barely feels. And so some of the drugs and the procedures that we do for atrial fibrillation confer significant risk to people, and you have to sort of balance the risk of those treatments versus the risk of AFib in that person. The hard part about AFib is that it's just so variable in how it affects individuals.
You know, this seems like you're really opening up this important conversation about the art of medicine and knowing how a disease affects someone. I had someone walk into my office a couple weeks ago, Dr. Mandrola, who you wouldn't have known it unless you looked at the nurse's record that their heart rate was 130. Just going along, and they were in atrial fibrillation, but totally asymptomatic. You came to our attention in large part because you were writing about this, the impact of thinking about how disease affects individuals in the case of screening tests. tell us a little bit of how you became interested in cancer screening, particularly as a cardiologist.
Yeah, so my interest in screening has been driven by this observation that a lot of the problems that I see patients for in the hospital are created by treatments of risk factors and things that they don't even complain of. So like you said in your comment just a second ago, was one of the first questions I ask a person when they're seeing me is, how are you? Not what the doctors say. How are you? How would you grade your health? And a lot of times this patient will say, I feel great. And so immediately I'm worried about making that person worse, because if someone has no symptoms, it's very easy to make them worse. And so that drove my interest in screening, because screening in so many ways picks up risk factors for disease and tries to inform the future probability of something that's yet to happen. My dad always used to tell me, John, stop worrying about something that hasn't even happened yet. And so over the years, that's how I kind of got interested in this whole probability thing in the future.
I remember my dad used to say, only worry about things you can do something about. And I do know it's really hard to improve upon someone who feels great. It's hard to improve upon that.
And that issue is actually at the heart. That issue is at the heart of screening, because if somebody has a potential for a future disease and we have something that we know can affect it, then maybe it's worth screening those individuals. But the problem is that if you look at the evidence, not just cancer screening, but lots of different kinds of screening, there's not strong evidence that a lot of things that we do to well people make a big difference going forward in the future.
And is there a particular screening test that you really have a problem with or you disagree with?
I disagree with misinformation. When, you know, the cancer screening, this cancer screening post that I wrote recently, sort of driven by this whole notion that cancer screening saves lives. And okay, that's not really true if you look at the best medical evidence. If you look at the clinical trials that compare, you know, not screened to screened people, it's very difficult to show that certain kinds of screening change someone's overall rate of death. And my thought on this is I'm 52 and I haven't had my colonoscopy yet, and you know, I'm getting beaten up by that by my doctors, but I said, have you looked at the data? There's no randomized trial that shows that it lowers my chance of dying. I don't have a high risk for colon cancer, and it may slightly lower my chance of getting colon cancer, but my overall death rate is the same. And I don't think people understand that. And I just, if someone chooses to get screened, I'm fine with that, but I just want them to have the information.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I think this is a really critical area to dive into more and talk about this, these choices and the information that we share and discuss. We're going to continue talking when we return with our guest, Dr. John Mandrola, electrophysiologist and columnist, about screening for medical disease. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Vani Murthy.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bhavani Murthy. We've been talking with Dr. John Mandrola, electrophysiologist and columnist, about communicating with screening in medical disease. And Dr. Mandrola, right before the break, you were really talking about the problems with some of the screening in terms of the data may not be so good for reducing overall mortality versus cancer-related mortality. You used the case of colonoscopy. What other diseases that we screen for have, in your view, similar sorts of problems?
I think the best example is prostate cancer screening with the PSA test. And the issue there is that, you know, the goal of these tests are to detect cancer early in a stage when it's more easily treated and potentially curable. But the problem with that is that, you know, that assumes a very old kind of knowledge about cancer, in that tumors are always slow growing. And tumors aren't always slow growing, and sometimes the cancers that you catch with the screening would be cancers that wouldn't harm anybody to begin with. And that leads to further testing. And further testing means doing more invasive things like biopsy, you know, actually putting needles into people's bodies, and then potentially even treating them with treatment for a cancer that wouldn't cause problems. And this is the problem with cancer screening, is that it often doesn't pick up the kind of cancers we want to prevent.
Well, you know, with prostate cancer, if we're not doing PSAs, and I think very few primary care physicians are really recommending them, there's some shared decision-making with patients, we don't have a screening test for one of the major causes of cancer deaths among men.
It's true, but that gets to my point about patients who don't complain of anything. If a patient is well, then, you know, there's just a feeling that I have that there's only so much I can do in terms of changing that person's overall risk of dying before I get into the specter of harm. And I really, after 20 years of practicing, I worry most about harm that we create in patients who are well. It's one thing when a person presents with disease, and if you're trying to treat somebody with a disease and they're having problems and they have a complication, you've done your best, that's one thing. But if you take somebody who's well and send them in for this or that test and they end up with a complication of that, to me, it's a never event.
And what specifically are some things doctors and patients can do to more responsibly use these tests and set realistic expectations for cancer screenings?
So I think the number one thing is just be truthful about uncertainty. Just communicate this uncertainty about what the expectations are of this test. And there are some people, take mammography for instance, there are some women who would be more comfortable just having the test knowing that there were potential harms down the road. But there are other women who, if given this information in a useful way, would decide that, no, I don't want to put myself through that. And the point is that how we frame that uncertainty is key. And that's an interest of mine, using language and using different tools to try and communicate that. But the notion that of using fear of you have to have this, otherwise you could die of cancer, the data don't bear that out.
You also suggest that patients should have access, or maybe doctors should routinely talk about benefits in the comparative of relative versus absolute terms. What do you mean by that, and how would that maybe change what you've just related about uncertainty?
So this is a key point, and it's when people say that a cancer risk is reduced by 30%, that sounds like a huge improvement. But if the risk of getting that cancer is only 1% and you go to 0.7%, then that's not much of a difference. And if we communicated, you know, if someone has a 1% chance of benefiting from this test, that means that there's a 99% chance they won't benefit. And I like to try and communicate both that 1% and that 99%. And that's not easy, and I'm still learning how best to do it.
And what kind of scientific evidence do we need in order to show that a particular screening test is more beneficial or more harmful? Like, what can be done to get better answers for these questions?
That's a great point, and I think that the first thing, an easy thing to say, would be to take people who are at high risk for a disease, take a high-risk breast cancer population, and study those patients, because those people with a high risk of disease, a high risk of cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, if you study those patients, there's a decent chance that you will show benefit of a screening test. The problem is that in the general population, the risk of having the cancer is so low that your chance of having a false positive is higher. So I think to answer your question, it's to study patients who are most likely to benefit and start there. showing some benefit.
You know, I imagine that as a cardiologist, you perhaps have faced some criticism among some, either in your colleagues or professional community, for taking a stance about screening, saying, well, what do you really know? But yet you sound incredibly passionate about doing no harm, which is the hallmark of what we're all taught as physicians to start with. What do you, how have you dealt with this personally? Because obviously you're saying things that have financial implications for healthcare around the world.
Right, right. So my view of this is, yes, I'm not a cancer expert. I'm not even a statistician, but I can look at the outcomes of randomized clinical trials, and I can see that the overall mortality, your chance of dying, your chance of being alive is not altered by these tests. And then I can look at how this is promoted in medical systems, and I object to that. And I'm not saying I'm a cancer expert, but I am saying that I can look at the data and I can say that the language we're using is not really right. And I guess my bias is that most of what I do in my clinical practice here is remove fear. Patients come in fearful of all these problems, too slow a heart rate, too high a heart rate. And what I do is I take away that fear. And how do I take it away? Just with basic knowledge. And that's just what I'm trying to promote, is basic fundamental knowledge and truth and what we know and what we don't know.
So honest conversations, shared decision-making, and language that perhaps doesn't, that takes away fear.
Absolutely.
How do you do that? sounds pretty good.
I think maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's just there's an old doctor here at my hospital, and he's like a guru, and everybody just, he doesn't speak much, but he basically told me one day, it changed my career. He said, John, we don't control as much as we think we control. And what he was referring to is that he's an ICU doctor. One day he does the same thing and the patient dies, and the next day he does the same thing and the patient lives. And his point was, you just have to be okay with not controlling everything. It was a pivotal day for me, because once I realized that I can't control everything, I became okay with communicating uncertainty.
And Dr. Mandrola, thank you so much. One of the final question I want to ask is, where can our listeners go to find more of your writing? And if there is any one final thought that you'd like to leave them with today?
Well, I guess three places. I guess I'm most active on Twitter at Dr. John M., and I try and tweet a couple things every day. Short writing, but I think it's useful. And the second place is at my blog, drjohnm.org, and then, of course, at Medscape. You can just find me as a columnist at Medscape. And I think the final thing I would leave you with is, just in terms of your listeners, is just to be truthful and honest about what the risks of treatment and testing is versus risk of the disease, and just to balance those risks of those two things, and to come to a decision that works for you.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. John Mandrola, Dr. John M., for talking with Your Health listeners about your work, your passion, your life, and your thoughts. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. John Mandrola about communication and cancer and disease. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bhavani Murthy. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bhavani and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question today.
I recently had cosmetic surgery on a mole on my chest that went wrong. I had an infection and I got really bad scarring, and now I feel like someone who's a leper. I believe the doctor didn't do a very good job.
Oh, this is hard. And I know we feel really bad that there was a bad outcome of what sounded like was a cosmetic surgery, maybe a mole that didn't look the way it looked and was taken off. That's hard.
And I think with any surgery, we need to remember there's always a risk of infection. When you go inside and you're touching with instruments, that the risk of infection is always there.
Yeah, the doctors in almost all cases should, and they would say that there's risk of infection, bleeding, and scar. Those are kind of common things. And infections aren't common, but boy, they certainly can happen for lots of reasons, many of which are not related at all to the technique of the surgeon or the technique of the primary care physician or the dermatologist, whoever took the mole off. So it can happen, but we understand that it's really disfiguring, and the scar, particularly if it's in a noticeable area, feels really bad to you, particularly if you're saying that you feel like a leper. That means that this is really hard. And so, but I don't know if I'd agree that it's really the doctor's fault in this particular case. And I think, you know, having a good open conversation with the doctor and also seeing what else can be done. Can you get revisions of the scar?
I definitely agree. And I think that it's just how it is, and that whenever you do a procedure, then that's one of the unintended side effects.
Yeah. So good luck to you. We hope that it gets better. We hope that maybe you can have a better outcome than where it is now. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I recently heard of a doctor going to jail for prescribing opiate medications to patients, and then they overdosed. How is this affecting your prescribing of opiates?
Well, that's a really good question. And I saw the same information in the news about physicians that are getting arrested, but they're predominantly having opiate shops. They're giving pain medications to people a lot of times for cash with very cursory examinations. And they're really giving regular doctors who are giving opiates for the right reasons to people with severe chronic pain a bad name. And they're killing people.
And I think it's important to remember, if you are taking an opioid medication, that there is something called naloxone that is available, that you can, at least in Durham County, you can get it from the health department, so that if something like this were to happen, then you have something that you can do about it.
Yeah. And as to how it's affecting kind of our prescribing patterns, I think that the pendulum swings sometimes, and sometimes it swings one way and swings another way. I'm thinking back 5-6 years ago when doctors were criticized for not giving opioids to people with legitimate pain, and a lot of colleagues started being more liberal. Certainly, it swung back the other way now, where providers have seen so many problems with opioid addiction and opioid overdoses, not just from these doctors that are having these cash mills, but from legitimate prescribing, where people are combining them with lots of different medications and anxiety medications and alcohol, and they're overdosing very young people. So I think that, how's it affecting my prescribing? Well, that case isn't affecting me, but being more cautious because I don't want to see people addicted, that's what I really want to do. What about you, Bhavani?
I completely agree. I feel like we need to make sure that a person's pain is under control, but at the same time, make sure that people are not becoming addicted to these medications, and be aware of our own prescribing practices so that we can prevent that and have an open conversation with the patient.
Yeah. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I've been trying to lose weight recently, and as part of my diet, I'm switching from sugars to artificial sweeteners. But my friends have told me that the artificial sweeteners could be bad for me. What do you think about that?
Well, boy, this is probably, we're opening up a large can of worms here. And I will say, for every piece of solid medical evidence, we probably are going to have more opinions, but I don't know. We'll do the best we can. Bhavani, what are some of your initial thoughts?
So generally, there are few artificial sweeteners that have been deemed or approved safe by FDA. Among those are saccharin, aspartame, and sucralose. Although these are generally safe, people who have phenylketonuria, PKU, should not use aspartame. But otherwise, even though they have been approved as safe, more research is still needed. And some research has shown that it may actually lead to weight gain.
Yeah, we call these systematic reviews, where they combine all this evidence together. And some of those reviews have really shown this association, just as you say, Bhavani, with increased weight gain among people who are using these sugar substitutes, which seems kind of counterintuitive. Like, if you're using diet soda, shouldn't you be losing weight? But it appears to have some impact on metabolic syndrome and adverse profiles here. So I think there really is some cause for concern. I'm not sure I fully understand the mechanism involved, but I think it could be real. But the other questions about these artificial sugars being blamed for a whole host of illnesses. I came up with one list recently, which was lymphoma, leukemia, bladder, brain cancer, chronic fatigue, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, autism, systemic lupus. Not so certain we can be the blaming of every disease on this. And certainly for diabetics, this is a really good option potentially for them if they want something sweet, but they don't want to raise their blood sugar. So there's some really good reasons for some of these.
And I think the verdict is still out there. And the true answer is we really don't know what the impact of these artificial sweeteners are and whether or not they're good or bad for you. And especially many people use it because they want to lose weight. But we don't really know if that really is the case, because is it that more overweight people tend to use more artificial sweeteners? We can't tell which way the relationship is.
You know what my philosophy is, Bhavani? Moderation in all things. I suspect if you have one diet soda every other day or so, it's probably not a huge issue. If you're using five a day of anything, it's hard to believe it could be really good for you.
I completely agree. Moderation is key for everything.
Daniel, what's our very last house call?
With all the news about the Zika virus, I've been trying to get some more insect repellent, and I'm worried about whether DEET is safe for me.
Well, boy, you wouldn't be alone, and I suspect there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people out there who are worried, but also perhaps going and using it more than they ever have.
And especially with the Zika virus outbreak going on, we always have to weigh the risk and benefit. And especially if you're a pregnant woman and traveling in a Zika-affected area, then we would recommend using insect repellents. And CDC and FDA has said that DEET is safe to use, even among pregnant women.
And there are lots of other agents that are available there that are used. But the DEET is one that is recommended. Some people like to think, oh, let me use something natural like citronella oil. Mm-hmm. But I don't know really if it's effective at, for instance, preventing the Zika virus. And certainly it's probably not as effective as some of the ones that are sold. So I think this is an area that you really should go with what's effective and safe, particularly if you're really trying to lower the risk. Now, one of the questions here would be about how young can the children? And I've seen data that children younger than 2 months, you wouldn't use DEET, but certainly over 2 months, it's safe. I've also seen that you shouldn't combine DEET with sunscreen for children, because the sunscreen can lower the effectiveness, and the DEET can lower the effectiveness of the sunscreen. So you probably should not buy the combination products for the kids, keep the kids out of the sun, and then the DEET.
And also some of the other products that are registered with the EPA include picardin and some oils. And so those are some alternative options to DEET.
Yeah, I've seen the oil of lemon eucalyptus, which is a widely used Chinese insect repellent. May be effective. So I think we're in the process of learning. We'll put some links on the website, but we really appreciate it. And thank you all for joining us today for some excellent questions. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can visit us at yourhealth@unc.edu, online at yourhealthradio.org. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. My great guest co-host today, Dr. Bhavani Murthy, and our guest today, Dr. John Mandrola. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Bhavani Murthy.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.